Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Having some solid evidence behind any recommendations for health advice sounds admirable. But you know, problems inevitably accompany anything humans get involved with. What is problematic and what is beneficial about evidence-based medicine? How does evidence-based medicine compare with just plain old experience and clinical judgment? How well does evidence-based medicine address an individual's healthcare problems? These are some of the questions that we'll discuss today with my guest, Dr. Andrew Schwartz. You can reach us with your questions and comments in Anchorage. You can call us over the next hour at 550-8433. Our local number again, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1 at alaskapublic.org. My hesitancy was later, I usually remind you, you have to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E at alaskapublic.org. Dr. Schwartz, welcome to Line One.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to meet you. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I didn't introduce you any more than to say who you are, so tell us, paint us a picture about what you're all about.
I'm a family physician. I live here in Anchorage. I have a little bit different background than many physicians. Out of high school, I was an aircraft mechanic in the U.S. Air Force. After 4 years of that, I attended the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and graduated from there and then attended medical school there and received an M.D. degree. I then went to a rural family medicine residency in Klamath Falls, Oregon, for 3 years and completed that. And out of residency, my first job was up in Barrow. Like many people, I went into the bush for loan repayment. I lived there and worked full-time for 3 years, and at that point, I moved down to the Anchorage area. And since 2003, I have been in the Alaska Air National Guard. I am a flight surgeon. I've been somewhat associated with the Alaska Family Medicine Residency. And I've been flying out to Bethel several times a month and mostly work in the emergency department there. So I live in Anchorage and work in the bush. It's kind of the best of all worlds.
So we're going to talk about evidence-based medicine. And I got to say, it just finally dawned on me, you're an ex-mechanic. And the only mechanic I've ever run into that really thinks with evidence-based medicine is Click and Clack, the brothers on Car Talk, who once did a program on coincidence and causality in mechanics. That's the only program. I tried desperately to get them to come on and talk about why don't mechanics ask me the history of my problem any better. But so how'd you get interested in evidence-based medicine?
A Cochrane review of mammography came out in 2001, and I will admit I didn't see it until about 2005. I read the conclusions and was quite baffled that they came to the conclusion that mammography did not seem to be providing a benefit. So I downloaded the entire Cochrane review, which that version of it I think was about 120 pages, and spent the next year or two going through it, trying to figure it out, downloading all the references and so forth. And that really started a journey which has just grown since then, and it has really become a passionate interest of trying to analyze medical evidence in a scientific, objective fashion.
So let's back up then and get some basic terms defined so we can be sure the public is hanging in there with us as we discuss this. So I'm going to ask you to start with what do you mean by science? How is science, how should we use the term science?
Well, there's several generally accepted definitions of science. I think many scientists think about the word science meaning the scientific method, which is a very step-by-step process of observing the world, creating a hypothesis, which makes a testable prediction, then performing an experiment to see if the results support the hypothesis or contradict the hypothesis. There's another, probably more lay term. When people say science, they mean all the accumulated knowledge of science. Mm-hmm. And they frequently refer to science as including all the gizmos we've made. So smartphones fall under the category of science. So I guess when I'm saying science, I'm referring more to the scientific method.
Yeah, a way of thinking.
Correct.
Yeah, that's how I think of it. And I think it's really important to think of the difference, because so many people get turned off by science as a bunch of data, a bunch of information, a bunch of mathematical terms, a bunch of chemical structures that I've got to remember. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about it's a way to the best way, it appears, to figure out what's real and what's not real about something that is testable.
Yes.
Right?
Correct.
All right. So that's what we're talking about when we say science. So medicine is somewhat, I guess, a branch of science. But what is evidence-based medicine? I'll let you figure this one out for us.
Well, for a very long time, medicine has been referred to as both a science and an art. And it comes and goes, whether it's more art or more medicine. medicine has a long history with science, and I would describe it as kind of a love-hate relationship where the two kind of come and go at times. There's references going back thousands of years of things that could be interpreted as science, and there was even a Persian physician who in, I think, around 1100 wrote the seven steps to test whether or not a compound works. Yet, prior to the last 200 years or so, that sort of stuff was really the exception and not the rule. And if you look at medicine in the United States, prior to about 1910, medicine was really a trade or a skill, and it was not academic. It did not involve the scientific method. It was passed along through apprenticeship, and many people were not very learned in what actually worked and what didn't. You just did what your mentor taught you to do. But during the 1800s in Europe, there was a lot of medical research going on that really was using the scientific method. And in fact, if you look at physicians in the United States in the 1800s, the most respected physicians were actually trained in Europe, and that used to be a mark of quality, is a European medical degree. And then around the 1900s, something really changed. The American Medical Association wanted to study the problems with medical education and the practice of medicine in the United States. And a gentleman named Flexner was commissioned to do a study of U.S. medical schools and compare them to European medical schools. And he toured the country and went to all, I think it was about 300 medical schools at the time. And when his report came out, it was very scathing about medicine in the United States. And it basically said, you know, there's no science going on here. The only school that seems to be getting it right is Johns Hopkins, which was a new school that was doing something very different. They were requiring people to have a bachelor's degree just to get into medical school. So the Flexner report came out, and it really changed things in this country. Over the next 10 to 20 years, the number of medical schools went from several hundred down to about 30. Following the recommendations of the Flexner report, medical schools were moved into hospitals in universities. Medical school faculty were required to perform research. And medical students were meant to be immersed in science, in the scientific method, all the way through medical school. So that's really the birth of what we refer to as modern medicine in the United States. So since 1900, medicine has certainly been based on science here. But it wasn't until the 70s, really, that people started saying, you know, having medicine based on science is good, and it has taken us a long way, but we really should be performing experiments of the treatments we have, not just assuming that the experiments done in a test tube that show that this medicine works are adequate. And Archie Cochran in Britain was one of the big people to really be critical of not just medicine in the United States, but medicine in the entire world, that there was very little true scientific evidence that what we did worked. And he pretty much started a revolution. At the same time that he was starting to say this, a medical school was started at McMaster University in Canada, and they hired a gentleman by the name of David Sackett, who decided he wanted the internal medicine program to be a very scientific program, and they were going to teach what they called critical appraisal of the literature. And really what that meant was not just using research, reading a research article, looking at the conclusion and doing it, but really critically looking at it and saying, is this a valid scientific study? So that started growing in Canada, and you'll notice that the United States is kind of out of the picture here. So things are growing in the UK, they're growing in Canada. So Archie Cochran got started something called the Oxford Database of Perinatal Trials in Britain, and with the goal to include every randomized controlled trial that had ever been done about perinatal medicine. And in the process of doing this, some have said he took perinatal medicine from being the least scientific medicine there was to being one of the more scientific branches of medicine. And that project came to fruition in about 1990 with the publication of a book called Effective Care in Pregnancy and Childbirth. And about that same time, the people at JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, were learning what was going on at McMaster University in Canada. And they decided to start publishing some articles in JAMA. And about that time, they came up with this term, evidence-based medicine. Now, to understand the term, you have to understand the term that failed. The term that was proposed at McMaster was scientific medicine. But the persons that propose it, they write very eloquently that when they propose that term for their method of critical appraisal and being scientific, they basically angered everyone because the bench scientists said, no, we're scientists. We're the ones practicing scientific medicine. And every other clinician felt that it was an insult because it was implying that they were not scientific. So they needed a term which would not offend anyone. And after playing around for a while, they came up with the term evidence-based medicine. Mm. And from there, it has grown wildly since about 1990 to where it really is the standard worldwide, or at least in name, it is the standard worldwide.
So in a sense, as we've moved away from this, I'm going to go work with somebody who is good in his field and learn how he does it, apprenticeship style kind of thing, to asking ourselves, is what we believe valid? Can it be shown to withstand critical thought and testing? And that's kind of what you're saying.
Yes,
that's where things have gone, and it's raised medicine. It's part of business now. The whole issue of science as a way of thinking is in the economy, it's in our businesses, our businessmen are thinking more critically and testing things, and medicine is doing that.
Yeah, what I would say, just to kind of paraphrase what you said, is if someone proposes a treatment and they say that it is beneficial, the scientific way to ask this question is, can I observe this effect in a controlled experiment? That's what a scientist would ask. And as Isaac Newton said long ago, if I can't see it or measure it in a controlled experiment, then it doesn't exist.
So is that reasonable? Perhaps I'll ask you, what's a concrete example of why knowing science versus and the evidence versus a belief is helpful?
Define what you mean by belief.
All right. So I believe that ulcers are caused by stress.
Okay, good question. So,
and that's the way I was actually taught 30 something years ago. Yet I understand now that science says that ain't true.
Well, or at least stress is a minor factor in ulcers.
Okay.
And the scientific method was used to, in fact, show that a bacteria, Helicobacter pylori, is the cause of ulcers. But there's also a lot of things around that stress. Once stress was not believed to be the cause of ulcers by the general public, it actually changed behavioral patterns in the presentation of ulcers and stress and so forth. And I'm just saying that to illustrate that the whole thing is very complex because mm-hmm. it's easy to do tests on rocks and rockets and so forth, but humans are very influenced by what they know and what they think.
Right, right. So there's some bias, which is another reason for science, is to try to control for our preconceived ideas, our preconceived biases, our desire to want to see something happen, our financial incentives, all of the above, which we're going to get into a little bit here. Let me remind listeners very quickly, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is Dr. Andrew Schwartz, and we're talking about evidence-based medicine. To this point, we've kind of tried to ferret out a little bit about what we mean by evidence-based medicine and science, and we're going to try to get into a little bit more practical understanding of why this is important and some of the problems. If you've got questions or comments about anything you hear today, please call us. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. We have a large number of very, very good references. If you're interested in knowing more about evidence-based medicine, pros and cons, arguments for and against, if you go to alaskapublic.org and find the Line 1 link, you'll see today's program and the listing of references, including a wonderful video that I'm very biased about, produced by somebody else that explains why maybe science is pretty damn important to all of us in the world. All right. So what else do we need to know about science? It seems like you're leading me down the path that maybe it's not perfect, this science or this evidence-based medicine. Is there some problems?
Well, neither science nor evidence-based medicine is perfect. And that has been accepted in science for hundreds of years. Science claims to continually move closer and closer to the truth, but I don't think any real scientist ever claimed that any belief at any particular time is the truth. there's some problems that have come out of the evidence-based medicine movement. Number one is the quality of the evidence. So there's critics of evidence-based medicine, and they say, how can you possibly make decisions based on the evidence when the evidence is so poor? And examples of that are lots of problems with peer-reviewed academic journals publishing things that are at times ludicrous, computer-generated gibberish. Other times, the most renowned medical journals publishing papers that are contradicted not very long afterwards. And those are certainly valid questions, and they point out problems in the publication process. I don't think they really indicate a problem in the whole theory of science. I mean, science really is trying to be as rational and objective as possible to find out what the truth is. So are there issues with publishing? Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, even one of the – I got to jump in here because we hear so much about vaccinations, and a lot of that traces back to a publication in The Lancet or the British Medical Journal about an association between measles vaccine, which has subsequently been shown to really be a travesty in a large number of ways. It had no truth. And it was really an observational study. It was never a cause and effect study by any means. And the person who wrote that has subsequently had the paper withdrawn. He lost his license in England. Sometimes there are mistakes made, but it's gotten worse. Recently, I think you've alluded to, and what I read is that there are now a whole bunch of publishers out that are asking people who do research to pay them to publish their research, and then they're telling us that this is peer-reviewed, that is looked at by specialists or experts in that area and okay them, and yet it's just a way to make money for it. And so the public must get very confused by, well, here's an article that's published and shows this, this, and this, and yet any critical analysis of that paper shows that that is not very good science for any number of reasons.
Yes. So what you're referring to here is something called predatory publishing. Which is an interesting term because predatory is never used in a positive way. But a really great idea was implemented about 10 to 15 years ago, and it was called open access publishing. The traditional model of academic journals is that the staff and the publishing costs are paid by subscription fees, and the authors submit papers. The journal, the editors review them, and then they send them out for peer review. And the submitted articles of the highest quality get published. The quality check always came in with the subscribers because people would drop their subscriptions if journals were publishing poor articles. The problem with this method is for everyday people to access the scientific literature was extremely expensive. And once you could access, once journals had online sites, if you go to a lot of subscription journals right now, they will charge you $30 to download a copy of one article. And, you know, it's frequently only 3 to 5 pages long. So that is a big turnoff. So someone came up with a business model that sounded great. And that is, researchers have grants, they have big budgets. Why don't we have the cost of this come out of the researcher's grant money? So the researcher submits the article to the journal with a payment. The journal peer reviews it, decides what to publish, and then the viewers all over the world can access it for free, and in particular, viewers in developing countries where there's not nearly the funds for big libraries to have, you know, thousands of subscriptions. And I certainly thought this was wonderful when it first came out. But in the last year or two, it has become clear that it is a highly abused system, and not all of the open access journals. But clearly, there are essentially fake journals being created, and I think now you can actually just buy some software where you can create your own journal, and people can submit articles to you with a submission fee of about $1,800, and it gets published in this online journal, and they claim to be doing peer review, yet it has become blatantly clear that neither the editors nor the reviewers are looking at it in some circumstances. And overall, the quality is poor in a lot of these journals. But I will say it's also driven by another problem, which is publish or perish in academia. So why are people submitting articles to these journals? And the answer is they're getting graded on the number of articles they publish, and that can have to do with tenure. So there's not a big incentive for researchers to be publishing high-quality stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take our break here. We're about 25 minutes into the program already. Things go very, very fast. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion on evidence-based medicine with Dr. Andrew Schwartz. And I'll start with an email that we've gotten that asks a very common and important question. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is family medicine and ER physician, Dr. Andrew Schwartz. We both have an interest in evidence-based medicine and science, and we're discussing the benefits and problems with this effort to improve the quality of health care in the United States and actually around the world. You can email questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or call us by a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday night, you're listening to a taped recording, and we won't be able to answer your questions or take your calls. So an email has come in, and it says, with the high cost of medical insurance or medical care, I'm going to edit that, they say medical insurance, why do insurance companies or the payers, including just insurance companies, there's others that do this, pay for treatments that are many times considered unscientific or unproven? For example, they say chiropractic, especially when other treatments like physical therapy may do the same thing. Is it all about lobbying efforts that finally won out? How would you answer that?
Well, first of all, medicine is a highly political field, and it always has been. And the allopathic physicians, which is what doctors with an MD are, have been at odds with other types of physicians for a very long time. So there are lobbying issues, but just because there is not evidence of a benefit in something, that does not mean that there is evidence of no benefit. And those terms are thrown around, and are misleading at times. I refer patients to chiropractors and to physical therapists. I think the evidence on this topic, now I certainly have not reviewed the evidence on this topic in the last 24 months or so, but the last time I looked at it, there was between allopathic physicians, chiropractors, and physical therapists, the least benefit was the allopathic physicians, and the chiropractors and the physical therapists both did better.
On back pain, I didn't hear
they did. On back pain.
Very specific
yep.
thing. Okay.
And right. I believe the outcome was getting people back to work.
Right.
Nobody did. Most people were somewhat better at 6 weeks. Nobody was good at magically making people's back pain go away in a week or two.
Mm-hmm. And there's some studies that show doing nothing, going to nobody, is about as good as anyway.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at certainly insurance companies deciding to pay for it, insurance companies have a lot of data that the rest of us do not have access to, mm-hmm. and their decisions are not as stupid as they appear on the surface. Mm-hmm. So it is quite
their motivations
possible.
Are different also.
They are, but it is quite possible that the best evidence in support of some chiropractic techniques is the fact that insurance companies are looking at their data and saying right. this is a cost-effective way
right.
for these
it's
patients
cheaper.
To get seen.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right, right. Okay. All right. So, yeah, because what you're saying, what I'm hearing you say is, I want to paraphrase this and tell me if I'm wrong, just because an insurance company decides to pay for something that might be unscientific, they're looking at it more from a cost-benefit ratio from their standpoint rather than a health-benefit ratio for the patient. Much as we may not like to hear that, that's what drives that business, I think. And again, I'm open for insurance people to tell me otherwise. But it's so our motivations are different in depending on where we're coming from. And they've got to make a living. And so that's partly perhaps why that happens. Okay. All right. When we talk about risk-benefit ratios, I have quoted some comments that I'm sure I'm plagiarizing from somewhere else, although I've used it so many times and for so long, I don't know where I got it. But I've always asked the question or commented on this program that any time a patient is being asked to do any treatment, that they often are asking me, what's the risk of the treatment? And I turn around and say, that's not the right question. The right question is, what's the risk of doing the treatment versus the risk of not doing the treatment? There's risk of not doing something as well. And so you have to base, look at both sides of that question. And then if you think about that a little bit further and logically, it seems to me, if a treatment has no evidence that it's effective, then why do the treatment, since all treatments have risk? So it begs the question that we really need good evidence that a particular treatment is effective if we're going to recommend it. Is that logical?
I would agree, and I would say that the best way to collect this evidence on both sides of the decision is a randomized controlled trial, because when you take 1,000 people, or frequently now it's much larger than that, it's 10,000 people in a similar situation and randomly assign them to the treatment group and the control group, it's very easy to compare the outcomes. It is much more complicated when you start going off observational studies that are, you know, based on questionnaires asked of people after the fact and so forth. That is where statistical manipulation comes in, and frequently the answer you get is based on who decided what statistics to use.
Mm-hmm. So controlled trials are the best way, and the problem even with a lot of where our medical-based judgments right now, if when people are looking at some of these, there are just not enough of these really, really large trials to really be clear, because there's cost, it takes a lot of time to do these, and people want answers quickly. So it's another source for problems to come into the whole idea of evidence-based medicine, is the difficulty, when you really get down to it, of really doing good science. Is that true?
That is correct. It is very easy to experiment on rocks, as Galileo did.
Or mice.
I was going to say it's a little more complicated on mice,
right?
But it is far more complicated on human beings.
Right. All right. So we've knocked evidence-based medicine. We've tried to talk about a number of different ways evidence-based medicine can be a little bit problematic, and I do want to talk about some benefits a little bit. Are we all crazy for going along with evidence-based medicine as a way to improve medical care, or are there clearly benefits that we have yet to discuss?
I think there are clearly benefits. We are all crazy to go along with anything that says evidence-based upon it. And it has become clear, evidence-based medicine has become so popular that just about every guideline that comes out says evidence-based on it, even when it's not. So part of evidence-based medicine is being critical. It's critical appraisal of the things you read, including guidelines. But evidence-based medicine is not about the conclusions of an article or a guideline. It is much more about the methods, and it requires that you actually read the methods and see if this thing was actually put together and if this conclusion was reached in a scientific manner. So are we crazy? Well, if we're just looking at everything that has evidence base written on the top of it and going along with the conclusions, yes, we are absolutely crazy and there will be lots of bad outcomes. But if we all start really reading the contents of at least the most important articles and guidelines and really saying, is this correct? You know, is this valid the way they reach their conclusions? I think it's going to be a much better world we're going to live in, and we're going to have much higher quality evidence to pass along to the next generation of physicians. And I think that's the goal of a lot of people in evidence-based medicine. I don't think that in 5 to 10 years, healthcare is going to take a giant leap forward due to the evidence-based medicine movement right now. I think what a lot of us are looking at is, what are we passing on to the next generation? And if we're passing on a belief that we really need to think critically and scientifically about these things, and we need to start a better system of performing randomized controlled trials, high-quality trials, we may pass something of immense value on to the next generation, which is a huge evidence base upon which to make decisions.
Mm-hmm. People, the public, again, I'm trying to always put myself in the public's eye about all of this, and It'd be nice to have somebody else from the public give us a call or send us an email about what they think about evidence-based medicine. But it seems to me that a lot of the public is confused about this because, for example, one day coffee is good. Next year, coffee's a problem. This year, you know, gluten is the thing we should avoid. Not too long ago, wheat was good for you. How would you answer that particular issue or that problem as the public may see changing recommendations coming out of healthcare?
Well, one of the problems is the way the media covers science and medicine. And you saw me shuffling around here. I'm looking for an article. It's in my bag, so I'll quote from it off the top of my head. But they looked at the most quoted scientific articles from big-name journals, and they looked at the newspaper coverage. And what they showed was that the small observational studies got far more coverage in the media than very large randomized controlled trials.
Right.
So what you end up with is evidence-based groups like the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, the Cochrane Library personnel, or the Cochrane reviewers, the American College of Physicians evidence-based review group, coming to one conclusion. And it seems to be, their conclusions seem to be completely contradicted by what people read in the media. And what I think doesn't come through is in the media, they like to concentrate on big effects, exciting things. But a lot of these big, exciting effects come out of very small, low-quality studies that are subsequently not reproducible. So it's not very exciting to talk about good, large controlled experiments.
So in a sense, what you're saying is where the public gets their information is confusing because the incentive of that large media organization, again, is to sell time, advertising, and so forth, not to get the story in the right perspective.
Correct.
So, again, it's where are you getting your information? But the public, on the other side, can't be expected to be able to review the greatest, best, most reliable information on mammography or prostate-specific antigen or anything very easily, or even interpret it, even if they could find a good review.
And I agree with that, but I would put out the challenge for those in the media who cover medical stuff to really start thinking about the quality of the evidence that they report upon and how they should at least quantify that quality when they report on the study by saying, you know, this seems to be an exciting finding, but this is a small observational trial and it's been contradicted in the past by numerous large randomized controlled trials. Mm-hmm. Whereas I frequently will hear something and my eyes roll back because I'm like, you know, that is just patently false. It is demonstrably mm-hmm. false. Mm-hmm. And it's reported like this is right. The latest, greatest finding.
Right. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you've got questions or comments or experiences regarding evidence-based medicine you'd like to share or ask questions about, call us at local number 550-8433. That's 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. Another thing about evidence-based medicine that's been somewhat of a knock is when you do a big controlled randomized trial, you get what most people or what would be beneficial to a large group of people, but it may not really well address individual healthcare issues. And I think that's a valid complaint. How would you address this issue?
This was very well addressed in a recent article in the British Medical Journal entitled Evidence-Based Medicine, A Movement in Crisis. And one of the things they've described is that evidence-based medicine has become so successful that everybody's taking this evidence and creating guidelines. And as a part of this, patients are really just turning into members of a risk group and not an individual person with their individual circumstances, their individual values. And that is a serious problem. And I don't know how that's going to be addressed within the medical field. That's going to require lobbying and so forth for people to understand that patients tend to want individualized medical care. They mm-hmm. want a doctor who's thinking about the five different conditions that they've got going on, how those five different conditions interact, how all the possible medications for those conditions can go together, what this person's life is, what their how many medicines they desire to take. Yet what we're ending up with this deluge of guidelines and these pay-per-performance standards is that someone comes in with five diagnoses, and for the doctor to get paid properly, that person's going to need to be on 25 different medications. And if your patient's not taking the medications, you're going to get dinged. Mm-hmm. So that's not what evidence-based medicine is about. Evidence-based medicine still recognizes the art of medicine, but that art is practiced with a scientific foundation of understanding what works and what does not, and integrating that with the patient's values and expectations and their individual circumstance.
Yeah. Andy, I had not seen that paper before we started talking, and you forwarded it to me, and I read that. And here's my response to this, very similar to yours, I think, is I think the authors of that paper missed the idea that these guidelines are exactly that. They're guidelines. They're not this is what must be done. They're a bunch of our best evidence on a particular topic that allows you to apply those to your individual patient's unique situation. And I didn't hear that discussed in there. So I think if you think of them as a guideline, as this is the way you have to practice, then it's not right. If this is a fund of knowledge, a review of the best information to be used in general, but applying it to individual situation, it makes more sense to me.
Correct. But I think there's certainly a movement in the bureaucratic aspect of healthcare to expect this to be applied.
Right, right.
You're
getting
everybody.
Measured, you're getting paid, you're getting dinged, you end up in the newspaper because you didn't follow
exactly.
the guidelines. Or you might be up for a lawsuit. People have argued about that. So they can get gamed again. That's when humans get involved in stuff, I should say. All right, here's another email. What kind of changes would you make based on evidence in our country's medical field to make it more affordable, practical, and of higher quality?
First of all, I think the public perception has a big disconnect between quality and quantity of care. Our society seems to feel that more healthcare is always better. And there's a growing fund of evidence that is in fact not the case. Many of the things we do in modern medicine are practically miracles compared to where we were 100 years ago. But everything is not that way. And I think we need more media coverage of studies showing that doing more is not better and is frequently harmful. I would also say that we really need a revolution in research. And what I mean by that is when the research is being funded by people with a vested interest, and by that I mean the pharmaceutical industry, and I'm not someone who's really negative about the pharmaceutical industry. I think they are doing their job. The problem is more the physicians, we're supposed to be keeping them in check. And I think we, in general, are doing a poor job of that. So I think we would get better quality research if a drug company developed a drug, and once they did a couple of small studies on it and thought it was beneficial, they then took the drug and a large amount of money, $100 million or whatever, submitted both of those to the NIH, who then decided which researchers would design and conduct a study to really get the drug companies out of the large randomized controlled trials to verify that a drug works. Their job should be to develop a drug. Mm-hmm. Someone more neutral should be testing it.
So one thing that to answer the listener's question is to do more evidence-based medicine on what makes sense and what doesn't make sense, that we probably are, at least from all evidence that I can see, we spend more than anywhere else, any other country in the world, almost by a factor of two, and yet our outcomes are less than most of the developed countries. So clearly more is not better. And that so the treatment and testing leads to its own costs and problems. And that the way we are testing treatments has some innate bias. I mean, part of this bias is all results need to be reported. Negative results often don't make it into the literature. And yet we need to know, if we're only hearing about positive results, we're not getting a balanced answer to the results that didn't show us what we wanted. And if you're a pharmaceutical company or a salesperson who's developing a certain thing, we want to hear the negative things as well as the positives if we're going to be able to make a real good judgment about the particular thing. So those are two things that we might do. So we're pleading, or you're pleading, and I agree, for more evidence for what we're doing and paying for those things that work. But boy, that gets political. I mean, the England is doing that right now. The U.S. tried to gild that into the Affordable Care Act, and it has not been well accepted. In fact, so well not accepted as you don't hear about it.
Correct. You know, again, medicine and politics are closely related. And so it seems like any time an evidence-based guideline comes out saying we should do less, somebody decides that there's some political ammunition in that, and we'll throw around claims of rationing healthcare and so forth, when in fact that's not at all what's going on.
All right. We have a phone call as well. I'm going to try to take that phone call. Chris, you're on line one.
Hi. I just have a comment. I don't think we have a healthcare system. I think we have an acute care system, and I'd like him to discuss that. And an example, my kid has cerebral palsy. My federal insurance, my husband's state insurance, doesn't cover AT for cerebral palsy.
Right.
Yeah,
there are a number of problems with our healthcare system. We'll address this kind of quickly, Chris. I know it's extremely important to you. We might be getting off the evidence-based issue here and talking more about our healthcare, which we've done several times on this program. But you're in the middle of one of the biggest problems that we've got, in the sense that we're not good at preventing chronic disease. We're not good at caring for chronic disease in this country.
Yeah, and I would agree. And, you know, So my specialty is family medicine, and certainly everyone in family medicine wants continuity of care and not an acute care system. Yet I work in an emergency department and provide a lot of acute care. It is complicated because the public seems to want care now, and there's numerous examples of that. Acute care facilities have proliferated. Everybody wants same-day appointments, which is great, but same-day appointments, unfortunately, decrease the number of appointments for people that want them further in advance. So I certainly empathize with your situation, but I don't know that there's any good evidence about how we can correct this, but it is, you know, certainly an area that could be studied.
Okay, Chris, thanks for your call. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. Is there any particular issue, Dr. Schwartz, that I have not addressed or asked you about that you'd like to comment on at this point?
Well, I think one thing that I was expecting might come up is the recent pelvic exam controversy that came out. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw in the news last week, the American College of Physicians came out with a recommendation saying there is no good reason to be doing annual pelvic exams in low-risk women, which on Google News, I think it popped up, the story popped up several times, and I read several of the links and then downloaded their review. And then immediately the next day, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology posted their reiteration that they think all women should get pelvic exams every year. And, you know, this is not an example of someone wanting to save money in the healthcare system or rationing healthcare. This is really a justifiable debate based upon the evidence. The committee at the American College of Physicians is all internists, so they certainly do some pelvic exams. But they went and reviewed what is the evidence of a benefit of doing pelvic exams yearly. And most of what they came to is there's not much evidence, number one. What little evidence there is doesn't seem to show any benefit. Yet when they look at the harms, which is psychological harm, and by that they meant, you know, women having to get pelvic exams, some have been raped before and so forth. So I read their review and it seems pretty objective. And this is something that's really, I think, moving into the forefront in evidence-based medicine is talking about prevention. So I'll give you a quote from Archie Cochran, who was really one of the founders of the modern evidence-based medicine movement. He wrote in an article in 1971, the article is called Validation of Screening Procedures, and he said, "We believe there is an ethical difference between everyday medical practice and screening. If a patient asks a medical practitioner for help, the doctor does the best that he can. He is not responsible for defects in medical knowledge. If, however, the practitioner initiates screening procedures, he is in a very different situation. He should, in our view, have conclusive evidence that screening can alter the natural history of disease in a significant proportion of those screened." And I think that's a very interesting perspective, that it is two different things. When the physician is approaching a healthy patient saying, "I want to do this to you." Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people in the evidence-based medicine movement feel the way that Archie Cochran did. I certainly do. And so that's mm-hmm. one of the reasons you have this recommendation coming out of the American College of Physicians, is they're saying, we're looking for evidence, we can't find it, and we don't think we should be doing something in a healthy person without evidence of benefit.
Mm-hmm. Because we may have be causing harm.
And we may. And there's substantial evidence of that, not particularly with pelvic exams, but related to that would be screening for ovarian cancer. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar mm-hmm. with the statistics mm-hmm. on that. We've got one large randomized controlled trial called the PLCO. It was conducted by the NIH. And in the part of the ovarian cancer screening, they randomized 77,000 women to screening with transvaginal ultrasound and CA125, which was a blood test. And the transvaginal ultrasound went on for 3 years, the CA125 for 5 years, and they followed those women for a total of 12 years, so 7 years after the last screening stopped. During the screening period, there was about 50% more cancer diagnosed in the screening group. But after the screening ended, that excess remained for the entire 12 years. The unscreened group never caught up, and that is what we call overdiagnosis. Mm-hmm. Those were indolent cancers that were almost certainly never destined to become a problem. More women in the screened group died of ovarian cancer than in the control group. And that is shocking for a lot of people to hear that, wait a minute, how mm-hmm. could more people die in the mm-hmm. screened group than the control group? And it's certainly because of all the overtreatment that went along with the overdiagnosis. But if you move the increased mortality aside and the increased cancers aside, which is no small thing, the workup of the false positives of the 30-something thousand women in the screened group, about 1 in 10 had a false positive, and one-third of those, so about 300 women, underwent an unnecessary abdominal operation, mm-hmm. and then a substantial number of those had complications from it. So this is, you know, one example where when people say it's not beneficial to do this, that is true. But not beneficial is sometimes a euphemism for something that is actually harmful. So I think that was also probably in the minds of the committee at the American College of Physicians that screening by ultrasound and CA-125 for ovarian cancer was actually harmful, and that was how it was described in JAMA afterwards.
But some of the rationale that came with that drove the changes in PSA, the prostate-specific antigen testing, and mammography. And I don't want the public to come out of this thinking all screening, and there's a tendency for all of us as humans to jump to conclusions. There are clearly screening tests that are extremely effective. Colonoscopy for colon cancer is the one that comes to my mind. We're in the last 2 minutes, and I like to sum up by just are finishing by summing up what we're really trying to say here. What is your point about evidence-based medicine we want people to take away from this?
Most physicians are trained on science and the scientific method, but the everyday practice of medicine pulls you further and further away from it because you get to know your patients, you get to care about your patients, you develop all sorts of biases, and you start believing in things that are demonstrably false. And that's when you really have to have the discipline to come back and say, you know, this
Maybe
seems
I'm
to
wrong.
Work. That's right. You know, it seems right to me, but the evidence doesn't support
it. I like that idea. I mean, I'm constantly telling people you need to be skeptical. You need to be skeptical about your own beliefs. I love the word skepticism. It's different from cynicism. It's just be skeptical. Show me the money. And you got to be not afraid to ask yourself if maybe what I believe is not correct, and keep an open mind about that. Great program. I really enjoy talking about this. I wish we could do it longer today. Perhaps we can do it again at another day. Thanks for taking the time with us.
You're welcome.
So my thanks today personally for our guest, Anchorage family and ER physician, Dr. Andrew Schwartz. If you'd like to continue the conversation on evidence-based medicine, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you'll also find a link to the Line 1 archives, and you can listen to this program again or refer someone to it. It's always going to be there for you to take advantage of. And if you wanted to let us know your thoughts and suggestions about the program, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to look at another issue. And let me start by saying, can adverse experiences early in life predict behaviors later in life? The evidence is accumulating that that is indeed the case, and we'll be discussing that very evidence with Anchorage psychiatrist Dr. Mark Erickson. So join us next week at 2 p.m. Also, I want to remind everybody, Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer here at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor and helped engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.